All right. With those technical reminders and a lot of very excited messages coming into the Q&A, which I'm glad to see, I think we can go ahead and get ready to officially start our session. So at this time, I'd like to call on Ashley to go ahead and pull up the presentation materials. And our very first speaker will be Michelle Burgess, who's joining us here from EPA's Superfund program in headquarters. Michelle, if you'd like to unmute, I want to make sure I have a good sound check from you.
Okay, hello everyone.
Excellent. So Michelle, I can hear you. Ashley, those slides look great. So if it's all right, I'm going to turn the floor to you, Michelle, so that we can officially begin our session today.
Okay, well, thank you all so much for your patience for waiting until August to hear this presentation. I'm very excited about this project. Just wanted to thank all the people who have been involved in this project, Stuart Walker, Lisa Ratterink, in my branch with the Office of Superfund Remediation, Technology and Innovation, also known as Superfund, in the Science Policy Branch. They've been incredible mentors and inspirational in this effort, as well as John Richards from our Region 4 office in Atlanta, woo-woo, for helping sponsor this as well. So thank you so much for that. So the purpose of this is phase three of developing a quantitative approach towards establishing regional screening levels for chemicals. Radiation has a similar calculator, but we really haven't had this for on the chemical side. And so these links here are the previous projects that were done by previous interns, and you can go and look at those, and I'll talk about those here in a second. But this one really focused on those gaps that were identified in the previous projects. And that was really, how do you quantify uptake of chemicals in plants? So the first one was just evaluating food consumption by people in state models for risk assessments. And so the objective was just to see what was out there and whether or not we could adapt it for our program and Superfund on a national basis, but also evaluate how those models were used for our site-specific evaluations. And that was gardening, farming, and hunting scenarios. The next one, which thankfully one of our interns came back, thank you, Ashley, is evaluating that uptake into edible vegetables, fruits, and herbs. And that project, which is all was a webinar that was previously done last December, was involving the research, anything that was involved with journal articles or international models, where we looked at the consumption of vegetables, fruits, and herbs, and particularly trying to hone in at Superfund sites where there was hazardous waste chemicals present and community gardens. And that was really what started this project many, many years ago, was when during the Obama administration, when Michelle Obama put a garden on the White House, this kind of exploded. And we started getting a lot of questions through the regional screening levels table, website, as well as other venues, as to, well, how could we, if we want to grow vegetables there or in our home or near a Superfund site, what do we need to be looking for? And so that's where we were trying to just pull all this information together and assist regional risk assessors and state risk assessors, for that matter, on how could we answer those questions and better inform what would be screening levels or best practices, even when you want to grow a garden in an urban, especially in an urban environment, but even near the Superfund site. So we did go to the states, and these are the questions that we asked, and we gleaned a lot of great information from the states and international communities as well, as to what kind of things do we need to look for when we're evaluating the risk to garden vegetables or edible herbs, and also what other research objectives are out there that would help us in evaluating that. And then the primary objective is to try to come up with a screening level in a calculator form to evaluate vegetables or fruits or edible herbs in a gardening environment. So I am going to turn this now over to these excellent interns, Ashley, Allison, and Aaliyah. Thank you.
Hi, I want to thank you all for joining us today. We are very glad that you took the time out of your day to listen to us talk about this. As Michelle went over, we are going to be talking about evaluating plant uptake of chemical contaminants in crops grown near urban gardening sites for human health risk assessment. And Michelle also went over this, but just for a little bit more detail of the first year report that was done. So this was just the comparison of risk assessment parameters for homegrown produce in various models. And here's just lists some of the objectives that you can look at in more detail later. The slides are on the Clewin website. And then this was just last year's report, goes over kind of the objective and purpose, and just kind of the purpose to what led us to this year's report, and just realizing the lack of information. We found an abundance of information, but then we also found significant research gaps that we felt needed to be rectified. So that is kind of where our primary focus came from for this year's report. So we are going to start this off with a poll, actually.
All right, so at this point, I'm going to launch a new window for the audience, and you should all now see a pop-up window that is asking a simple background question. How many years of experience do you have working with risk assessments of contaminated sites? There are a series of options. Simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best matches you, and then hit the submit button. Once we've gotten most of the audience having shared their responses, we'll go ahead and close the poll and take a quick look at those results. And I'm seeing about 3/4 of the audience having cast their vote. So with that, I'll go ahead and close the poll. And if you can't see the poll, you can simply type a response into the Q&A. That also works. So again, that question is how many years of experience do you have working with risk assessments of contaminated sites? You can just type in your answer in the Q&A if you can't see the poll. I'll go ahead and close it now. 3, 2, 1. And share those results. So it looks like almost 40% of our audience has more than 10 years of experience, but the remainder of the audience has less. So about 16% are brand new. And then the other portion of our audience, the other mix, I'd say roughly a little less than half, is somewhere between 2 and 10 years.
Perfect. And now I'm going to hand the floor over to Allison.
Hello. So over the past few years, we have seen an increase in urban-based community and personal gardening. And so with this, a rise in public health concerns surrounding these gardens due to their close proximity to industrial sites and heavily trafficked roads have increased. However, all soil research that has been coming out in recent years has usually been primarily focused on these forest and agricultural lands with little exposure to these urban soils that we are now researching and looking up. This lack of data is the driving force behind our project, and we hope to gain and develop information needed to help create a effective and accurate risk assessment method at these agricultural urban sites. So in order to address these concerns, we begin our research by identifying contaminants of emerging concerns, which are also known as CECs, commonly found in these urban gardening sites. We also divided these CECs into two different groups. We have the trace elements, which are seen on the left, and the persistent organic pollutants, also known as POPs, seen on the right. And also you can see on this little table the different common sources of these two groups of CECs. So in terms of trace elements, lead seems to have the most sources from these different contaminants. And in terms of POPs, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, also known as PAHs, were the most prevalent in these sources. With that being said, I'm going to walk you through kind of each contaminant or contaminant group that's in our list of CECs to kind of show you more in depth of what we've researched so far. So here is lead. As you can see, there's a high prevalence in the more northeastern side of the United States. This is most likely due to industrial site wastes not being contained, as well as heavily trafficked roads and stuff like that. Next is zinc. Zinc is also another industrial runoff contaminant, but also it's found within naturally within soil, which causes some higher levels of it, but the like the red that you see is most likely caused by the industrial runoff. Arsenic, also found naturally in soil, but also another one that's caused by industrial runoff, as well as heavily trafficked areas. Copper, another one that's also naturally derived, especially in the southwestern United States. You can see a lot of copper in our soil here. But it is also caused by industrial contamination as well. Nickel is another that is caused by industrial contamination, and it also is caused by heavily trafficked areas. You can see it a lot going across and up the western coast of the United States, with a little bit kind of spattered around the rest of the United States. Molybdenum, you can see really focused in the Ohio and Pennsylvania area. That is caused by a lot of industrial use there. It's also spattered around a lot through the rest of the United States, but it's mostly concentrated in that area of Ohio and Pennsylvania. Selenium, also seen within the Ohio and Pennsylvania area, but also going across and up the East Coast, as well as parts of the Midwest in the United States. This is caused by actually selenite that's exposed to water, which then dissolves it. Selenite's a mineral that's found within the soil, and it's water soluble. And so when water hits it, it dissolves and then can get into your soil and then into your plants. Cadmium is another industrial runoff. It is seen a lot in Idaho, Montana, a little bit in Wyoming, kind of in that area of the United States, not really seen in the southeastern United States. But like I said, it is caused by mostly industrial runoff in heavily trafficked areas. And then mercury also, it can be found naturally in soil, but a lot of its contamination is caused by industrial use, as well as heavily trafficked areas. That's a very common theme within all of these trace element CECs. You can see it a lot in the northeastern United States, as well as across the west coast of the United States. And then chromium, also industrial runoff, surprise, as well. You can see a lot of exposure and contamination across the west coast of the United States. And let's see, barium as well, industrial runoff and contamination seen throughout the mostly the western United States has a lot of this contamination, not really seen in the eastern side of the United States. Oh, and I believe it is a poll time.
All right, so we are going to load another poll question this time. And this next question, as I'm launching it here on the screen, is asking how many of years of experience you have working with health risks related to the exposure of contaminants. So we're refining that background question for you just a bit, offering you those same choices. Are you brand new? Have you been doing this for 2 or fewer years, 2 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, or more than 10? Again, simply click the circle and then hit the submit button. For anyone who's unable to see that poll question for whatever reason, it's just easier. You can type your response into the Q&A, simply letting us know how many years of experience do you have working with health risks related to the exposure of contaminants. So now, as I'm looking at those responses slowing down, I'll go ahead and close this poll here in 3, 2, 1. And with 86% of you having responded, again, we're seeing a similar distribution. About 40% of them have more than 10 years. About 17% are brand new. And then everyone else is sort of falling a little less than half of the audience between 2 to 10 years of experience.
Okay, so I'm going to now hand it off to Aaliyah.
Thank you, Allison. Hi, everyone. My name is Aaliyah Peku, and I'm going to be telling you guys about a risk assessment for potential exposure to CECs in these urban agriculture scenarios. So to start off, the three exposure routes to CECs in urban soils are ingestion. Now, if you look over here on the right-hand side, I have a diagram made for you guys, and that helps visualize these three different pathways. So ingestion, that could be ingestion of the contaminated food or crop grown in the garden itself, or that could be ingestion of the contaminated soil particles directly. Now that occurs more often with babies that are, you know, touching babies or young kids that are crawling around more often, hands to mouth more often, whereas the contaminated food might be more for, you know, above that population. Inhalation is the next exposure pathway, and this includes inhaling contaminated soil particles directly. So these very small contaminated particles are in the air. You're breathing them in when you're working by your garden. So that's the other pathway. And then our final pathway is dermal contact with the soil itself. So if you're in your garden, you're planting, you're touching the soil, your hands are getting direct contact with it, no gloves. That's the third way to come in contact with contaminated soil. And then moving on to our actual health risk assessment portion. Now, there's a variety of health effects that are associated with CECs. And as you guys know, as Allison spoke about, there are a large number of CECs. So the health effects vary based on a variety of factors, including the CEC itself, the exposure duration, the pathway, and host factors. So an in-depth assessment of the health effects associated with individual CECs or the associated CECs, that can be found in our report. But just looking at this table, you can see an overview of some of the human health risks associated with the CECs and all the systems affected on the left-hand side. And then you can look over on the right-hand side and see some of the observed effects that are associated with each system. So, you know, there can be smaller effects such as nausea, and then we can have the more extreme side of it where you can see lung cancer, different types of cancers. Some of these CECs that we're dealing with are carcinogens. So if you're coming in contact with those, there is, you know, obviously a chance of cancer, not all of these CECs though. So you can see that nervous system effects seem to be the most observed in terms of CEC, just looking overall at trends, as well as respiratory and dermal effects. And then I'm going to pass it over to Ashley, and she's going to talk about uptake of chemical contaminants.
Perfect. And we will start this off with a poll with Jean.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and launch one more poll here on the screen. And now we're asking our last background question, this time asking how many years of experience do you have working with plant uptake and translocation of chemical contaminants by plants, either urban agriculture or rural agriculture? Again, simply pick from those time-based options. If you're brand new, 2 or less years, 2 to 5 years, 5 to 10 years, or more than 10 years, and then submit your response. For anyone who can't see that question or the pop-up window, go ahead and type your response into the Q&A. Simply let us know how many years of experience you have working with plant uptake and translocation of chemical contaminants by plants, whether it's urban or rural agricultural settings. All right. Again, it looks like we've got about 85% of you voting. So I'm going to go ahead and close this out here in 3, 2, 1. And let's look at those results. This is interesting. We've got a bit of a shift here in our responses. Overwhelmingly, almost half of the audience, this is brand new for them. So that is certainly a shift. So we might have a lot of experience in some aspects of it, but not in this specific area for those attending. So I want to thank everyone for chiming in and sharing that with us. Ashley, I'll turn the floor back to you.
Perfect. Thank you, everyone, for doing that poll. That is definitely kind of what I expected just from the research we've been doing and realizing that plant uptake specifically for CECs, specifically even more in urban soils, is kind of a very new area in the past decade or so. And a lot of that comes from the difference between forest soils, traditional agricultural soils, and urban soils. So urban agricultural soils are highly variable chemically and physically at fine geographic scales, reflecting the various management history of individual sites. So urban soil systems differ from their rural counterparts in terms of their physical and chemical properties. Consequently, plant uptake findings from rural agricultural soils do not directly apply for risk assessment of urban soil media, and this leads to a huge barrier in trying to quantify the contaminants of emerging concern in urban soil. So I will be highlighting the environmental factors, plant physiology, and soil characteristics that can play a crucial role in the uptake and translocation from soil to plant systems. So here, this diagram here, I know it's a lot to take in, but this just summarizes the potential for uptake and accumulation of contaminants of emerging concern within the edible parts of crop plants. So the environmental factors influencing uptake and translocation of contaminants by plant systems can be represented through the evapotranspiration rate, which is also known as the KC value. The evapotranspiration rate of crop plants is determined by climatic and plant-specific values, and it is a very good indicator for the ability of crop plants to uptake and accumulate contaminants in their tissues, which would then lead to the contaminant possibly being able to go into the edible parts of the plants, because an increased evapotranspiration equals an increased contaminant uptake. The most common environmental factors include temperature, wind speed, air humidity, the climate of specific agricultural areas, and soil moisture. And as indicated by the plus and minus signs on these tables, literature has found that high temperatures, high wind speed, low air humidity, hot and dry climates, and adequate soil moisture content accelerate the evapotranspiration rate of contaminants by plant systems. So a little bit more background to understand the plant physiology parameters is vascular plant tissue is composed of the xylem and the phloem. The xylem is a unidirectional transport system for water and minerals, whereas the phloem is a bidirectional transport system for organic molecules. When water and solutes enter the plant root through the epidermis, the organic contaminants in solution either cross the root membrane and transport through the vascular pathways to the aerial tissues, or they can accumulate in the plant roots. So one way we can tell, kind of predict what contaminants might do in different species and classes of plants is based on the bioconcentration factor, which is also known as the BCF. Bioconcentration factor can be used as an indicator of a chemical substance's tendency to accumulate in the plant. So this takes into account the plant genotype, the growing season of a specific crop, the overall plant health, evapotranspiration values, net irrigation requirements, which is the amount of water required to produce a healthy crop, and the concentration of lipid content found in the plant roots. So the factors show in the plus column of the plant physiology table that the system in which the bioconcentration factor of plants is increased, with therefore allowing water and nutrient uptake and photosynthetic efficiency to increase as well. So overall, increasing a plant system's ability to uptake and translocate contaminants. And experimental results also revealed that the potential for contaminant uptake by urban crop plants decreased in the order of leafy vegetables being on top to root vegetables, cereals and fodder crops, and then to fruit-bearing vegetables with the lowest bioavailability for uptake of contaminants. Inherent properties of natural soils, such as the organic matter content, known as the soil organic matter, which you might see abbreviated as SOM in many literature, is the type of soil, the pH, and the aerobic versus anaerobic conditions play a critical role in affecting contaminant uptake by plants. And so this has to do with the soil properties. So an aerobic environment is characterized by the presence of free oxygen, while an anaerobic environment lacks free oxygen, but it still may contain atomic oxygen, which is bound in compounds such as nitrates, nitrites, and sulfites. So I know that was a lot of information to kind of dump at you all at once, but next we're going to go into the physicochemical properties of pollutants, because not only does the environmental and plant physiology and soil factors all influence the plant uptake, but the physicochemical properties of the specific pollutants also can have a huge effect. So one of the main ways to determine this is the transpiration stream concentration factor, which is known as the TSCF. And this is the ratio of chemical concentration in the transpiration stream to the concentration found in the external solution. So the physicochemical properties of contaminants of emerging concern, they play a crucial role in the uptake and translocation from soil to plant systems. Some contaminants are highly stable and therefore less likely to undergo conformational change during interactions that occur during the uptake and translocation processes. So the transpiration stream concentration factor can be utilized as a tool to determine the overall uptake of contaminants from soil to the xylem of plants. And then the molecular mass of contaminants is the leading pollutant-specific physicochemical property influenced the plant uptake process. The uptake and transportation of pollutants in plant phloem and xylem depends on the size of the molecule, which directly corresponds to the molecular weight of a molecule and compound. For example, organic pollutants with small molecule size can easily permeate the membrane and hence easily come and go out of the phloem and xylem of a plant. On the other hand, organic pollutants of large molecule size have low permeability in membranes and therefore cannot be effectively transported in the phloem. So, and another aspect with molecular weight is compounds with low molecular weight are volatile, which means that they can easily be absorbed by the roots and foliage of plants. So you're not only, so it's giving you an increased chance that it's going to get to those edible parts of the crops. And then in the contrast, high molecular weight pollutants, they are non-volatile and they possess strong hydrophobic properties. And that means they can only be absorbed by the roots. And so a compound's tendency to dissolve in hydrophilic or repel hydrophobic water can be linked to higher / lower TSCF values. So that's also a huge factor, is if the compound specifically loves water or very strongly dislikes water. So contaminant uptake and translocation by plants. So contaminant uptake by plants, it generally follows two main uptake pathways. You have extracellular transport, which depends on the nature of the elements only, and the physiological conditions have no effect on uptake rate, or little to no effect, but not one that matters significantly. And then there's intracellular transport, and this depends on the pollutant factors, plant biological characteristics, and the environment media factors. So studies have shown that contaminants are enriched at the root surface and enter the roots with water. This mechanistic step is in agreement with the previous literature stating that hydrophilic compounds, being the compounds with a higher affinity for water, have a higher uptake rate than the hydrophobic compounds, like we discussed in the previous slide. So contaminants can penetrate the roots through the cuticle-free cell walls of young root hairs located closely behind the tip of the root. And contaminants then travel to the xylem transport tissue in the root along free intracellular space or cells. And the cell wall of the root cortex is porous, which allows for contaminants to move freely from solution to the interior before they reach the endodermis. The general approach for examining the bioaccumulation of organic chemicals in terrestrial plants includes measuring either the root or foliar uptake, depending on the properties of the chemical or the most relevant route of exposure. And it must be noted that exposure rates may differ depending on the consumption of the root or the shoot or the fruit of any given plant, therefore potentially posing different health risks. So that's another area we have to look at as well, is, you know, some plants, the contaminants might go to the shoot more, but we care more about the fruit, and the fruit has less of the contaminants being transported to it. So that's another area of research that is a bit more complex, kind of more like an organization of all the information and data, to see what is like general trends and what possibly is actually really relevant to urban growers and gardeners for best practices. So further research in this area would definitely allow for a more thorough risk-based assessment that takes into account the varying plant species and their subsequent edible parts. And plant systems also have what is known as the green liver concept, which is probably my favorite thing about plants, where plants have enzyme-based mechanisms that can detoxify contaminants. So a lot of the times, plants are able to say no, and they're able to, you know, convert them through chemical mechanisms. But the problem is, as I previously mentioned, a lot of the contaminants of emerging concern are incredibly stable. And the ones we're highlighting today are often lipid soluble, meaning that when the contaminants are taken up and translocated across plant tissues, the green liver concept of plants is unable to detoxify the contaminants, unfortunately. And here is just the following diagram just details the factors previously mentioned and how they affect uptake and translocation. It's just another helpful diagram to kind of be able to visualize all the information I just piled on to you guys. And the following uptake by plants, the pollutants are translocated to different parts of plants, and generally two kinds of pollutant transport pathways have been reported for the translocation portion. We went over the uptake portion, so now we have moved on to the translocation. It can get a little confusing because they like to use a lot of the same terms for intracellular and intercellular transport, which those are both known as short distance transport. And then you have conducting tissue transport, which is also known as long distance transport. And currently, agreement on a formal mechanistic approach for contaminant translocation by plants is not present in abundance in literature. So we have also found that literature focusing specifically on urban soil media translocation is very hard to identify. So next we're going to talk about quantifying uptake of contaminants across plant species. So we have all this information about plant uptake, and, you know, we kind of better understand the health risks, but at the end of the day, it's being able to quantify that information and see how we can apply it to whether it's a screening standard, which is the ultimate goal, or even just best practices for urban growers. So fruit vegetables growing under controlled greenhouse conditions, for example, cucumbers, green beans, tomatoes, were found to have a higher potential to uptake and accumulate contaminants of emerging concerns in their edible parts compared to plants cultivated in open fields. And this was due to the longer growing and irrigation period and the higher net irrigation requirements, and which I previously have mentioned is the amount of irrigation and water that the water is required to produce healthy crops. And then the water requirements met solely with irrigation, no precipitation events occur in protected agriculture. So that is another factor. And then fruit vegetable crops uptake and accumulate contaminants of emerging concern based on their reported bioconcentration factor and net irrigation requirement values. So applying the uptake models to urban gardening scenarios allows us to quantify the uptake of contaminants of emerging concern across plant species. As you can see on the bottom of this slide, there's just kind of a brief example of kind of what plants have less and more bioavailability and chance of uptake. And we're going to go through this more in more depth in the next slide, but that just kind of shows you a little sneak peek of this slide. So this is the data presented here. It indicates that leafy vegetables, so your lettuce, your spinach, your cabbage, and celery, they constitute the crop plants with the highest ability to uptake and accumulate contaminants in their edible tissues. And this conclusion is based on the bioconcentration factor values for the contaminants of emerging concern. And then you can see here for the lowest potential for CEC uptake by plants, you have a lot of fruit trees and other non-leafy vegetable plants. Leafy vegetables are really the ones that have the highest problem. And from the research that we were looking into, it really seems to possibly have a lot to do with the passive diffusion that is able to happen from the all the contaminants. And then the leafy vegetables, it seems like they just have, they're very good at transporting the nutrients that they need to transport to all of their beautiful leaves. But unfortunately, that means that those sneaky and pesky contaminants can, they can hijack that cellular transport mechanism and very easily sneak along in there. So that poses a risk as well. And we are now going to finish up the plant uptake portion with one last poll.
All right, so I'm going to launch a new poll, and this one is a short or long answer, depending on how much information you might have, but it's a free text response poll, simply asking if any, what plant uptake models have you heard of or worked with previously? If you have not heard of any others or have not worked with any, you can simply close the poll or put none and submit that response. We'll leave this open here for just a few moments, but we do want to be sure to carry on with a few final thoughts here before we take our Q&A break. So as I'm buying just a little bit of additional time waiting to see if more responses are going to come in, I'll remind everyone we have a fantastic queue of questions that have come in. So if you've submitted a question in writing, please know we are going to break for Q&A and we'll start reading through some of these for a response in just a moment. Again, if you have no additional information, it's equally as helpful for you to just simply type in none into that response and then hit the submit button. So again, if you can't see that poll question, you are certainly welcome to type a response into the Q&A and let us know what, if any, plant uptake models you might have heard of or worked with previously. So I'm going to go ahead here and just close this one out in 3, 2, 1, reminding you can continue to share thoughts. If you have additional links or references, if we've closed this one out, you can put them in the Q&A. We'll be capturing all of that and sharing it with our presenters. So I'm going to end this one now. It looks like about 40% of the audience responded, and I'm going to go digging through those responses in just a minute and circle back to share a quick summary of what we see. And I'll turn it back to you, Ashley, to carry on, but I will chime in with a summary of responses in just a moment.
Thank you. And next, we're going to move on to bioremediation methods. And I believe I'm handing the floor to Aaliyah on this one.
Thank you, Ashley. So we're going to delve into remediation of contaminated urban soil. So when we were looking at remediation, we went through a large amount of scientific research papers and different remediation methods. And we found that bioremediation seems to be the best option for the home gardener. And that's just because this is very cost-effective, minimally invasive, and it's beginner-friendly. So it's not, you know, a scenario where we have large-scale commercial agriculture and we have remediation experts. This is supposed to be targeted for someone who's at home and wants to start a backyard garden and just needs a little bit of assistance. So bioremediation is the focus of our remediation aspect. And in addition, this is a great method since it is also very environmentally friendly. So two different types of bioremediation that we're going to focus on are phytoremediation as well as mycoremediation. And other methods may be more effective and may work quicker or be a little bit more time efficient. But these other methods tend to be more expensive and are often more invasive and require expert knowledge, which isn't really accessible to the average home gardener. So other methods I just want to point out are soil washing, thermal treatment, electrokinetics, and there's plenty more. But like I said, we're going to focus primarily on bioremediation for this section. So the first type of bioremediation that we're going to focus on is phytoremediation. Now, phytoremediation can be broken up into many different specific techniques. And this method utilizes natural plant processes to remove or degrade soil pollutants. So like I said, this can be broken up into a bunch of different techniques. You'll hear it broken up a bunch of different ways. Sometimes two different things are actually the same. But we're going to be mainly focusing on phytoextraction, phytodegradation, and phytostabilization because we found that those are most applicable techniques in terms of urban soil because they allow for the contaminants to be efficiently removed from the soil. So over here on the right-hand side, if you take a look, I have a little diagram that depicts the different types of phytoremediation. So just to give you a brief summary, we have phytoextraction, which is also called phytoaccumulation occasionally. And this involves uptake and transport of the contaminant into the plant tissues and leaves or leaves. And then we additionally have phytostimulation, which that involves stimulating the like natural soil microbial activity in order to promote decomposition or degradation. We also have phytostabilization, which involves the plant roots immobilizing the soil contaminants so they're not able to go up into the tissues or the stem part of the plant. Photovolatilization, that's just releasing the uptaken contaminants in a gaseous form into the atmosphere. Phytodegradation, also called phytotransformation sometimes, that involves the plants releasing enzymes that are able to break down or degrade the contaminants. And then we also have phytofiltration, which involves using the roots to essentially uptake contaminants in aqueous sources or water. And that basically is able to clean out the water, essentially. So for the studies on phytoremediation that we looked at, the CECs that they were most applicable to were trace elements, dioxins, OCPs, which is organochlorine pesticides, PCBs, which is our polychlorinated biphenyls, and PFAS, which is, as many of you know, per or polyfluoral alkyl substances. So our limitations that we found with phytoremediation after reading through all these different research papers were that time is a very limiting factor. Phytoremediation is a passive technique, so it can take years, which may not be, you know, super feasible for someone who wants to start a garden and wants to have their tomatoes grown by next year. You know, so this may not be the best solution if you're pressed for time, or we also may just need more research to find ways to expedite the process. Another limitation is depending on the severity of your soil contamination. If the contamination is way too high of a level and you have, you know, it's overtaken with heavy metals, you're not gonna be able to grow any plants at all. So you can't do the phytoremediation because those plants aren't gonna survive in that type of environment. So those are just some things that need to be researched to figure out whether phytoremediation may be a suitable remediation method. And then moving on to mycoremediation, this is very similar to phytoremediation. This is a method that utilizes fungi to remove or degrade soil pollutants. So once again, I have a diagram for you guys. This just illustrates biodegradation of pollutants via mycoremediation. So mycoremediation can occur via biodegradation or bioaccumulation, similar to the phytoaccumulation method. But the main one that we're focusing on in this report was biodegradation. So if you look over here, you can see we have our mushrooms or fungi, and then the fungal mycelia. These green enzymes are being secreted by the fungal mycelia. And basically those enzymes are very good at degrading lignin, which is a very tough material. So the enzymes are also able to degrade these pollutants and these contaminants oftentimes because they are very similar in chemical structure and makeup and, the strength of them. So you can see we have our secreted enzymes, and those will eventually reach the pollutants over here in the bright red. And then the degradation process starts and we'll end up with our degraded pollutant. So once again, for studies that we found on micro-remediation, the CECs that they were most applicable to were petroleum products, dioxins, trace elements, and PFAS once again. In terms of limitation, we found that lack of research was the main limitation. Micro-remediation seems to be a fairly new concept. So in order to determine, some of the other things that we determined with phytoremediation already, like what's the time efficiency on it, and what type of soil does it work on? Does it have to be super contaminated? Does it have to be a low contamination rate? Does it have to be like very contaminated? We just need more research and studies to be conducted just to determine the effectiveness of micro-remediation. And then I am going to pass it over to Allison, and she is going to tell us about guidance for urban growers.
Thank you. So some guidance for urban growers, we're going to first start out with some best practices. There are many different things that you can do to make sure that you're planting in safe soil. The first main thing to do is to definitely research the area in which you'll be gardening, looking for any kind of agricultural work that's been done in the past, any kind of industrial use on that site or near it, or any other things that can raise the chances of CEC presence in that area. You want to locate places that are away from old painted buildings, factories, or heavily trafficked areas due to the increased risk for a higher presence of CECs in those areas. Another thing you can do is get your soil tested. Most state universities, you can send a soil sample that you take to their agricultural department, or you can do it to privately run labs as well. There are a few across the United States, and they will test your soil for trace elements as well as some other CECs like the persistent organic pollutants. Another thing you can do is researching any of your pesticides and fertilizers for any concerning chemicals. Now, this is more of a preventative measure so that you aren't putting any contaminants into the soil. But it's just a quick little Google search to make sure that there isn't any documented issues in that state or certain suppliers of that fertilizer or pesticide companies that have shown any kind of past containing CECs. Also researching your plants, what you're going to be planting and how they absorb CECs in comparison to other plants that you could be planting instead. Like it's been discussed before, root vegetables like onions and carrots, they can have a higher chance of being contaminated because their fruiting bodies are in the soil with the contaminants, as well as those leafy greens that are so good at taking up contaminants from the soil, unfortunately. Some other things you can do are using soil amendments to stabilize contaminants in the soil. So adding a thick layer of organic matter to your soil, which provides a physical barrier between your plants and contaminants. They've also been used to bind contaminants, like we've discussed before a little bit with the bioremediation, which make it so that those contaminants are no longer mobile and bioavailable, which soil amendments also just improve the overall soil quality for growing plants and are a good addition to any soil, whether or not you think that it's contaminated. Another kind of more drastic thing you can do is removing all contaminated soil and replacing it with clean soil. This just makes sure that all of the soil that your plants are coming into contact with have no history of contamination. Also, using these bioremediation techniques, utilizing the plants that we discussed in the previous slides to extract, degrade, and contain or immobilize contaminants in the soil, or mushrooms as well, as we discussed. Like also discussed before, this can take years and it's not effective for every single contaminant that we've discussed. And it can require special handling for the disposal of the plants that have been used to make sure that the contamination doesn't spread. And finally, when in doubt if the levels of contaminants in your soil are within safe limits, you can always grow your plants in pots with clean soil just to make sure and really just lower the chance of your plants getting contaminated. Next, we will discuss just kind of like how soil testing is done in these labs. Now, for trace evidence, there's a few different ways. You can buy commercially sold kits online. They are available on a few different websites, and these allow for your ability to test your soil at home. You can also, like I said, contact your state university or privately owned labs and see if they have any way of testing your soil for you. Now, these kits that you purchase to do at home, they only test for a few trace elements that can be present in the soil. They don't test for a wide range of them. And they're you can mess them up, so they can be not as accurate as sending your soil sample off to a lab. So some of the things that the labs use to analyze the soil samples that you could be sending them are they can use inductively coupled plasma mass spectroscopy, which is ICP-MS, which is an analytical tool or technique used to measure and identify elements within a sample matrix based on the ionization of the elements within the sample. And then it separates out the ions by the mass to charge ratio. And then the computer that it's hooked up to kind of reads that out, and then it spits out basically what kind of elements are in these and what kind of chemicals are in these. Another one that can be used, another technique, is inductively coupled plasma optical emission spectroscopy, ICP-OES, which is another analytical technique used to determine how many or how much of a certain element is in the sample. Next, we will be discussing what is used for the persistent organic pollutants. There's multiple different ways that labs can do this. There's gas chromatography mass spectroscopy, or GCMS, which is a method used for detecting volatile and semi-volatile organics. This is done by dissolving your sample using reagents and then putting that through a column on the GCMS that then separates molecules of the sample by how long it takes for these molecules to travel through the column after they've been turned into a gas, which is where the gas for the gas chromatography part comes in. These different molecules will come in off the column at different times depending on their size and composition, and then these molecules travel to the mass spectrometer of the GCMS, where they are captured, ionized, accelerated, deflected, and detected individually. This is done by the mass spectrometer breaking each molecule that was vaporized by the gas chromatography stage into ionized fragments, and then detecting these fragments by using a computer that the GCMS is hooked up to, and then it will tell you which chemicals are in there, how much of each chemical is in there, and so on and so forth. Another method is LCMS, which is liquid chromatography mass spectroscopy, which is a very similar method to the GCMS in the way that it analyzes samples. The one key difference is the mobile phase when you're putting in your sample. The mobile phase of the LCMS is liquid, which is where the liquid part of the liquid chromatography comes from, in comparison to the gas that is used for gas chromatography for the GCMS. Another analytical tool is the high performance liquid chromatography. It is a technique in analytical chemistry used to separate, identify, and quantify each component in a mixture. So it does a very similar thing to the last two that were discussed. It's just another way of doing it. And then the last is in ICMS, or ion chromatography mass spectroscopy, which can be used to separate, identify, and quantify a wide range of compounds in complex samples, including those from inorganic, organic, environmental, and biological origins. So that method could be used for both trace elements and persistent organic pollutants. But it was just a different way to labs for analyzing these contaminants in their soil. So next, we will discuss the regional trends that were found for plants grown across the United States. So in region one, which includes Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, it can be seen that there were common crops across this region, which were beans, corn, cucumbers, lettuce, spinach, and tomatoes. Region two, which included New York and New Jersey, there were also regional trends that were found, which were asparagus, cabbage, carrots, cauliflower, corn, cucumbers, eggplants, kale, lettuce, okra, onion, radish, spinach, and tomatoes. Region 3, which include the states Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, and West Virginia. Again, there were regional trends through these states as well. The most common crops that were in this region were corn, lettuce, radishes, and tomatoes. Region 4, which included Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. The most common plants seen here were beans, cabbages, carrots, corn, cucumbers, okra, radish, spinach, tomatoes, lettuce, as well as beets, bell peppers, broccoli, and sweet potatoes. Region 5, which includes Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. The most common crops in this region were cabbage, cauliflower, cucumbers, lettuce, radishes, apples, asparagus, carrots, corn, and tomatoes. Region 6, which included the states Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and New Mexico. Again, more regional trends, which were cabbages, corn, cucumbers, eggplants, lettuce, okras, pumpkins, and tomatoes, carrots, cauliflower, onions, sweet potatoes, and potatoes. Region 7 also showed regional trends. The states in Region 7 were Nebraska, Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa. And these regional trends were broccoli, cabbage, carrots, kale, lettuce, okra, potatoes, radishes, spinach, and tomatoes, as well as asparagus, beets, beans, cauliflower, corn, eggplants, cucumber, onion, peas, and sweet potatoes. Region 8, which included the states Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. The most common crops in these region were cabbages and tomatoes, as well as cucumber, corn, lettuce, and onion. Region 9, which is Arizona, Nevada, California, and Hawaii. The most common crops in this region were carrots, corn, cucumber, eggplant, lettuce, okra, onion, radishes, and tomatoes, as well as beets, broccoli, potatoes, pumpkins, and sweet potatoes. And then finally, in Region 10, the states were Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And their most common crops seen were apples, beans, cabbages, carrots, cucumber, onions, tomatoes, radishes, as well as asparagus, corn, potatoes, lettuce, and cauliflower. And that is it for the guidance of urban growing, or for urban growers. So I'm going to hand this back off to Ashley to continue with the research gaps.
Thank you. And next, we're going to be finishing this up, and we're going to talk about the research gaps. So we are going to be highlighting 5 research gaps that we feel of our high importance. And the bold ones don't have any specific importance. It was just to easier differentiate between the large amount of text on the screen. So for the first one, plant uptake models that can encompass all classes of contaminants. So our research has shown that there is not a singular plant uptake model or even general trends of specific plant uptake models used across all classes of contaminants that we have identified today. And there are obviously some very obvious limitations and challenges with this, where there's many different types of plants and even plants within plant species. And you have the same thing on the contaminant side. You not only have classes of contaminants, but then you have individual, like you can have up to hundreds and hundreds of individual chemical compounds within each of those classes. And while they have a lot of similarities, you don't have the research to know specifically is one substituent of, one changing one element on that compound, like what is that going to change in the result of uptake and translocation in various plants? And next, another one is how can we quantify the bioavailability of individual contaminants across plant species? So this kind of goes off what I was saying with the first one, where there's hundreds of chemical compounds can exist within each of the classes of contaminants. And although we can generalize these compounds as similar, how can we quantify how readily available they are to be taken up and translocated by plants across a variety of plant species? It is a lot of information to cover. And from our findings, that information is not readily available in large quantities. I think it's definitely that specific area alone, I think, could be a paper all in itself, because I think if we tried to tackle it as well as we could, but we just didn't feel like we had sufficient amount of information to make this report already longer than the 30 some pages I believe it already is. So to spare everyone from having to read 60 pages of a report, I think that would be a very wise next step. And then moving on to what are state-specific plant uptake models. So what are individual states using? So we got in touch with state risk assessors, and we attempted to get in touch with some state agencies, but it's posed a challenge on getting specific information in abundance. We're able to get different bits and pieces of information from different offices and state officials, and we're obviously thankful for everything we get, but I think possibly having surveys, more specific surveys instead of broader questioning, might be more beneficial moving forward, so we have some more concrete data to move forward with. So kind of just thinking about how can we survey what plant uptake models each state are using, if any, to better assess the current risk assessment of contaminants in urban soil. And for number four, it's what role do non-EPA agencies with authority to protect food supply, agricultural resources, and public health have in developing baseline standards for food production? This was one that was in, we had the same research gap in the last report as well. And this one kind of goes towards how the whole goal of our now 3 years of this project was to be able to provide some sort of national screening levels and standards for contaminants emerging concern across plant species and crops commonly grown in urban gardening. So just thinking about, you know, who else to reach out to, what other agencies to get and have collaboration with to maybe move towards and shift our focus towards more towards that goal now that we're slowly building up more and more information. And lastly, a better scope on the variability in plant uptake and exposure risk of contaminants of emerging concern within plant species. So this kind of just goes off where, you know, we know the specific kind of exposure risks and plant uptakes of the classes of compounds, but seeing how possibly that is different within plant species and just being able to focus on that. And I think that's kind of poses the same problem as I previously mentioned, where that exposure risk itself across plant species of contaminants of emerging concern could be its own paper. So I think just trying to focus on possibly those research gaps independently instead of moving forward, trying to put them all in the same report again. So that is the end of that. And we have one last poll.
We do, Ashley. So with that, I'll invite the audience to take a look at the last pop-up poll that has appeared on the screen, asking another free text response, what specific research gaps do you believe the team may have missed? Now, if you think they haven't missed any and they've identified everything that's there, you can also simply put none in your written response. So I encourage you all to take just a moment and share your thoughts in that short response poll. While we're giving people a few moments to share their thoughts on that question, I do want to circle back to the earlier poll where we asked them other plant uptake models that they'd heard of or worked on. And I do want to note that most of the audience said that they hadn't heard of anything else or worked with another one. However, a number of people did point out some others. And I may be mispronouncing it, but it's BAES, B-A-E-S, or B-A-E-S et al., is one that a number of people have referenced from 1984, the RAICE, R-A-I-S calculator, Travis and Arms. Multiple people have talked about the BCFs per ECO SSLs. There have been other references to the NAUM, N-A-U-M calculator, a Navajo Abandoned Uranium Mine calculator, the TRRP risk equations. We also have LEACHIP, LEACHIP, or L-E-A-C-H-P, these are all acronyms, PRISM, RISQ, and again, if I'm butchering the acronym pronunciation, my apologies, but the key point here is that a number of other models were referenced here in some of the responses. So I do want to thank everybody who chimed in and shared those with the team. We'll be taking your responses and sharing it with the presenters after our session today. All right, I think I may have bought enough time for those who are going to chime in on any specific research gaps. So that was the subtle hint to go ahead and finish up any messages you may be putting into that Q&A, because I'm going to, or that pop-up poll window, because I'm going to close this poll here in 3, 2, 1. And I'll just let you know, if you had or were in the midst of sharing some other research gaps, you can continue to include those thoughts in the Q&A, and we'll capture everything and share that with the presenters. So let me go ahead and close this poll window, and I'll turn the floor back to our presentation team.
Thank you, Jean. And this is just our contact information. This is the end of our presentation today before we move into the Q&A section. And I just want to thank everyone on behalf of all three of us for showing up today and providing the information that you've provided. I can speak from experience of doing the webinar last year that the information that we got was vital to us even being able to lay the foundation for this paper. So if you think you don't make much of a difference, I promise you any information you give us is amazing. And we have, it's almost a struggle of when you have, we have too much and too little of research out there. So sometimes it's too much of the vague research and too little of kind of those key pieces that we need to really kind of put the puzzle together. So we just really appreciate everything. And I will turn the floor over to Jean so we can begin our Q&A.
All right. So I know a number of the audience, many of them, if not most of them, have been typing in questions diligently throughout your presentation. I'm going to spotlight all three of our presenters today, and I'll start reading through those questions. We do have plenty of time for a nice Q&A segment here, so I encourage everyone to stay with us. For those of you who have questions more about logistics in terms of the recording and participation certificates, I promise we're going to cover all of that at the very end today, so hang tight. So let me jump right on in with a question that came in almost at the literal start of the session, Ashley, and this gets into the definition of the scope of your study. Somebody wanted you to clarify, what do you mean near home ground gardens as opposed to in a home ground garden? Can you explain the phrase near a home ground garden?
Yes, I believe if they're referring to near contaminated urban sites and like the verbiage of our title, what we mean by that is that a contaminated urban site can be nearby your urban garden. So you can say you have your urban garden here. We'll just pretend this is like a mile apart or something, and there's a contaminated site previously known even a mile away, with the runoff and everything, all the other factors, environmental and everything that we went over, all those factors can still influence your crops. So I think it's just kind of the verbiage of it, of how it can be in or it can be near, and you can still see those same effects.
All right. And then we're going to carry on with some earlier questions when you were going through lists of the common anthropogenic sources. So Ashley, I think this one is going to come back to you again. There was a phrase that you used, MAH, or an acronym, and someone isn't sure what MAH means.
Yeah, that is monoaromatic hydrocarbons. So you have the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that people are very familiar with, the PAHs, and the mono aromatic hydrocarbons, that includes the BTEX compounds. So I do not remember those all off the top of my head.
No problem. I think we have benzene, toluene,
like toluene, and yeah, all of yeah. So if you research the BTEX compounds, that could help you a little bit more. But our previous report is linked on, I believe, the CLUIN webinar website, and that we went into a lot more depth of all of the contaminants. We just couldn't really spare the space to in depth go through them all again. So we have a lot more details on every single one in that paper.
Okay. And also on that list of sources, a number of people chimed in about including PFAS with sewage sludge. So just a recommendation for updating the list. I also wanted to thank the audience for chiming in with that. We did have another question though about other sources. And one of the attendees asked, what about lead paint as a source of lead in gardens? It seemed like that would be a pretty obvious one for home gardeners that maybe are painting those gardening boxes. Any thoughts or comments on that suggestion?
I believe that might be on the list that Allison showed. I don't know if she can go back and bring up the table or not. I think it might be on there, but maybe I'm seeing something different.
You are correct. It is on there, but let's see how fast I can speed run go back for everybody. Oh, you didn't realize how many slides you went through until you have to go back to it again. Oh, I went to
I think it's on slide 11, and I think it might be paint before 1978. Yep, that top column, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then that is lead.
All right. The next question, then I'll jump over to you, Allison. When you were talking about metals, one of the attendees just wondered some of the metals that you were talking about earlier in slides. You were somewhere in your maps, I think slides 11 through 14. Someone wondered if the source of some of the metals you were referencing could be from use of coal. Is that a possibility?
Yes. Let's see. I don't remember which specifically. Let me go through them really quick and see if I can remember. But I do know that there are at least a few that are commonly found from coal burning or wood burning.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could remember which ones. I want to say that arsenic might be one, but I could be completely wrong because it's been a while since I've looked through these. But yes, okay. That is definitely a possibility for some of the sources of that contamination.
Okay. And Aaliyah, I'm not sure if they were aiming this question at you or at Allison, but one of the attendees noted about all the metals that were showing up in the Western U.S. Couldn't those be simply attributed to mining activities?
Yeah, that would be for Allison. But yeah, I think it would be definitely attributed for mining activities, considering we have a lot of mining going on over there on the West.
Okay. All right. I believe this question now goes to you, Ashley. We were in our late 20s slide deck, so somewhere past slide 27. In one of your slides regarding forest and urban soil pie charts, there we go. One of the attendees wondered, why does the forest pie chart still show a large amount of inorganic soil? How would you define inorganic soil compared to organic soil?
Honestly, that is a question that I have not been asked, so I'll be completely honest with you. I'll answer to my best of my ability. But from what I have gathered, it has a lot to do with the organic soil, the organic soil matter content, and how the inorganic soil is just what is more bioavailable in nature. I could definitely be completely wrong on that, and there might be someone who schools me with a better answer, but I also found that to be very interesting. When I first looked at these pie charts, I really thought they were going to be a lot more different than they are, especially because a lot of the literature says you really can't apply, the models from one to the other very well, so you would think that they would have more vast differences.
Yeah, and I can just add on to that real quick as well. The organic soil tends to be more of like the humus layer with a lot more nutrients, soil nutrients and microorganisms, whereas the inorganic tends to be more rock-sized particles and, like silt, sand-sized particles.
All right, thank you. All right, Ashley, I'm afraid I think this is still back to you when you were showing a diagram of some of the parts of a plant. And so one of the attendees was referencing in the slide, it shows the quote aerial parts of the plant as being subsurface. Is that correct? If so, could you explain the aerial parts?
Let me see. I know I passed it. I'm trying to find. I think it just went. It went crazy.
It was literally the slide just past the pie charts. So it was the potential for uptake.
I was pushing buttons and it decided to have a mind of its own. So we're going to start over on that.
We're around slide 28. There you go.
Perfect. Okay. Sorry, can you repeat the question so I make sure I answer it?
Sure. So they simply wanted to confirm if the aerial parts of the plant are in the subsurface. And if they are, can you explain what these parts are?
From my understanding, the aerial parts of the plant are meant to be the ones that are above the surface. I definitely, now that I'm looking at this diagram, it's the first time that I've, like, it's been brought to my attention. I definitely see where the line of that is not in a great spot, but it also technically the shoot of the plant still will be submerged in the, you know, the subsurface a little bit down into the roots. So the majority of the aerial parts of a plant are above ground, but you can, as you see in this picture, have a small amount that can be in the subsurface. And that especially happens for a lot of those leafy vegetables and like carrots and stuff, which since they're not only their roots are in the soil, but also like the body of the plant, that kind of has the same concept where it plays into how much contaminants can be taken up and translocated.
Okay. We have a question. Our next one is just, there were a number of trace elements that were discussed, and I think they were referenced or sourced from, quote, industrial runoff. And one of the participants just wondered, was stormwater runoff sampled? They're wondering how you may have compared, or if that information was compared relative to natural background levels, because they're a little concerned that some of the patterns aren't really lining up if it's just from runoff. It seemed more like it was just a natural background pattern that you were observing as opposed to coming from industrial runoff.
I know I can speak from experience with a lot of the research that we've done in the past, like 2 years now, where I would probably say 90% of the research I have come across has had a, what they call a natural soil background that is their control that they are comparing it to, their standard. I don't specifically know exactly what diagram the person is referencing in question, so I can't 100% say that. I don't know if it's the ones that Allison went over and if Allison has a better idea, but I do know that they generally have a standard.
Okay. All right, excellent. And if that in the, essentially that what they were, they're coming back in with additional parts to this question. They really just wanted to know what data drove to the conclusion that these elements are really just an issue of transport and runoff. And I think they're talking about some of the colored maps. So Allison, it might be referencing some of the information you were showing.
Let's see. Let's get back to the, where are the maps? Where are they at? I think I went to the other way.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you repeat the question one more time?
What they're really trying to ask is, how did you conclude that the elements which were sourced or said that they were coming from industrial runoff, what data led you to believe that? What did they do, any other measurements? Did they look at background, or like, did they look at stormwater runoff? Like, how did they decide that that was really coming from industrial runoff? Because they're just concerned some of the patterns they're seeing, they don't think it would line up with runoff. They think it's really more of a natural background issue.
Mm-hmm. I do know that, especially for selenium specifically, this one is a lot of natural background. Just because of the way that it's found in nature as selenite, and then, you know, it dissolves with storm water and everything like that. But on the same resource that I got all of these maps from, it had descriptions on the side that discussed how they were, how they did their collections and everything, and how they had, like Ashley said, the controls and everything. in that a lot of these were, in comparison to those controls, they were higher than the controls were. It's been a while since I've looked at them, but there were, it did describe like how they did reference these controls and that, yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. I have a two-part question that's going to come your way. This may be for Ashley, might be for you, Allison. I'm trying to take notes here, but it's not clear. The first one is asking, do conventional water screening levels or water quality benchmarks dominate the risks that you're looking at? Or are there cases where water risk is insignificant, but plant risk is significant? So in other words, what's in the water is not an issue that's going to cause a problem, but it's been uptaken by those plants and either transformed and I believe bioaccumulated to a plant, or now the plant is a problem.
Hey, this is Michelle. I think that's a kind of a two-parter on that mm-hmm. one, because in the risk assessment world, we do look at water risks from people ingesting the water.
Mm-hmm.
And this was part of the project to see about irrigation and whether or not, you know, people could use contaminated water to irrigate their crops or whatnot. It wasn't a primary focus of that.
Okay.
So I'll let the intern speak to this, but we really did not quantify that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the lack of knowing more about this question, and I'm always happy to have this conversation with this person, I would say the ingestion of water is probably a greater risk
okay.
to a person than the uptake from a plant. But again, this was not the primary focus of this particular project. We were trying to get at that, but we are still, that's still in the gathering okay. phases, if you will.
Okay.
I don't know. Ashley, Aaliyah, Allison, do you have other thoughts?
I definitely agree with you, Michelle, on that. We did do some background research on use the wastewater irrigation and the effects that can have, and it just ended up having to be something that was kind of cut in the end from going in more depth for space and trying to have a more narrow scope on for the paper. But from what the research that I was looking at was the wastewater irrigation, the wastewater itself, or, you know, wastewater specifically, but even if it wasn't wastewater, the water itself was an issue, but it was not always an issue in the plants. It was plant species, like plant family specific on if waste, even like wastewater irrigation, where you know, obviously you're not going to be drinking wastewater, but some crops they were finding it was perfectly fine, and some crops they were finding it was an absolute disaster.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of factors that go into that.
Okay. And they actually had a second part to their question, and I don't necessarily think we have to spend a lot of time on it, but it's just further extending. If water is the issue, right? And then water resources are being depleted, it's being reused, and there essentially are a lot of other factors that are resulting in higher concentrations of these anthropogenic substances in our irrigation water and our biosolids. You know, wouldn't that ultimately then drive poor overall water quality everywhere and just exacerbate the problem? But I think, Michelle, you've already sort of responded that the water would be the bigger risk, very likely. And so clearly, if we're accumulating more of these materials in the water, yes, that would drive things right up. Right?
Yeah. And I think we just also need to frame it in the Superfund realm
mm-hmm.
as well as a bigger issue that they may be raising. Mm-hmm. We, like I said, we did explore that because I know there were some projects that ORD had funded in the Western regions of looking at that. For instance, you know, we know almond crops take up a lot of water, but, mm-hmm. You know, we were really trying to focus on Superfund specific.
Okay.
So that may be, if our ORD friends are still on the line, they may want to look into that.
Future topic, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Just a quick clarifying question. This one should be an easy one. Can you confirm that the inorganic materials like chromium are also taken up by plants, that it's not just limited to organic pollutants, it's also the inorganics as well?
Yeah, that's correct. It depends on the plant type, but yes, the inorganic materials can also be uptaken by the plants.
Okay. Other question just about the transmittant process. Do plants transmit pollutants to the seeds that they're generating?
I believe, yes, in some way. I would think that because it can be transferred from root to the fruits and the edible parts of the plant, that I would assume if it can get into that fruit, I should be able to get into the seed, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yeah, I would say yes as well, because it can like transport to the fruiting bodies, obviously. So I would say the same thing.
Okay. And we did have a question about fruits. So one of the attendees noted a common garden or agricultural plant type that I don't think they saw discussed earlier was simply berries, like berry bushes like blueberries, or plants like strawberries, or vines like raspberries. Would they be similar to grapes?
I'm going to go to that slide to better refresh my brain on classes of plants. Let's see.
Yeah, again, I think that would be chemical specific, because, you know, I think just thinking about the physiology of plants, it may depend on whether or not those particular fruits take up water more than other fruit. And so if that chemical is more water soluble than, say, other chemicals.
Okay.
That might be something for our collaboration with our ag friends on that one.
All right. And we have had individuals noting exactly on what you're highlighting, Michelle, on the chemical specific nature of some of this, even just that the manner in which the uptake happens can vary significantly by the compound. One of the attendees noted that the uptake for some CCs like PFAS is more impacted by protein content. And they just said that these are factors that should be considered when you're compiling your uptake and accumulation information, because not all of the chemicals are going to follow the same uptake patterns with other, like other organic contaminants do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's been really difficult. And again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate y'all's Ashley, Elia, and Allison, your dedication to this project, because I think you're seeing this is been a difficult project for many, many years for that reason. So many things that y'all have pointed out that it's not a one off thing, like one kind of particular thing. So yeah, thank you.
All right, Ashley, I know you got to this slide, so I don't know if you wanted to make an observation here before we move to our next question.
I think honestly, I'm agreeing with what Michelle said. Where from the research I was specifically looking at, the berries were not mentioned, and because it can vary so greatly, this is even this itself is a very broad generalization. Just because, as they were saying, as a one person commented with the PFAS and proteins and such.
Okay. Did you look at any studies on contaminant uptake by aquatic plants? They were wondering or thinking specifically the types of plants that are used for basket weaving, where the time of exposure to the plants might be a lot higher than the ones that you're ingesting.
On my end, I don't know about for Ashley and Allison, but on my end, no, we did not. I think we just kept it to like common garden crops.
Okay. Okay.
I would have to agree with that as well. We did not look at aquatic.
Okay. Can you just offer a little insight on why greenhouse plants would have a higher net irrigation requirement? And they're asking because they assume these plants would not experience wind and have as much fluctuation in temperature and weather condition as opposed to outdoor plants. So why would they need more irrigation?
So from what I took from that information, is that even though they're not being exposed to necessarily the same conditions of being outside. They're in very, you know, specific, a very controlled system. But even though we have the downsides of the uncontrolled system, like being in the great outdoors, also the precipitation does a lot for the cycling of nutrients and other things, where, you know, sometimes we get floods in the spring, and that's a good thing because we need to circle those nutrients around. And so I think that plays a big role in it as well, because you're not getting the wind and even the pouring rain that is really almost like naturally tilling that soil. So you kind of have to manually do it in your own way. So I think that plays actually a big role in it, that sometimes there's a lot of pros and cons, I think, for a controlled environment.
Okay. Aaliyah, this one might be for you. Any thoughts about using wood chips to manage soil moisture in urban gardens?
I think Allison briefly touched on this when she was talking about using soil amendments. So I'm going to turn it over to her.
I can say from like personal experience, because I do a lot of gardening at home and I live in Arizona, so it's always really dry, really hot. Wood chips are a good thing to use, especially as an organic layer, like also discussed. They are good at keeping moisture. It's just, you know, making sure that you get the right wood chips and everything, and get wood chips that aren't going to mold when they're, you know, exposed to water all of the time.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what effect it would have specifically on the uptake by plants. So that would probably be something else that needs to be further researched, if it would have an effect or not.
Okay. One of the attendees wondered if you had encountered any comment or note of using cover crops during the non-growing season to take up any excess contaminants. Did you encounter that idea in play in anything?
Sorry, go ahead, Ashley.
I guess I'll go quick then. I personally did not see that on the urban side, because that is something that I looked into from growing up around a lot of fields. I was something that, you know, cover crops was something that kind of like rotating fields and such was an idea that I thought of. So I personally didn't find anything, but we'll turn it over to Aaliyah if that was different there.
Yeah, I didn't find anything else either, but I think it would probably kind of tie into the phytoremediation aspect in a way, like using the cover crops to try to take up some of the excess contamination. Didn't see anything specific about it when I was looking through those research papers on phytoremediation of CECs, but maybe it was in there.
Okay. All right. Now we're going to get to a whole group of people who want to know more about those resources for home gardeners to test their soil for CECs. Several people have asked if you could just revisit those lists of options. And specifically, one of you mentioned that universities will test soil. Is this really free? How do they find out?
I think this is the one that I talked about. Yes, universities will test your soil. You have to make sure that they have, you know, an agricultural department. So looking up if that state university has an agricultural department will probably be your first step. And then getting in contact with them, most of the time at the bottom of their website for that department, they'll have a phone number or an email. You can contact them and you can be like, hey, you know, I heard you guys test soil, or, you know, state universities test soil. Do you guys do that? And if so, what are the procedures? Most of the time, you'll package up your soil in an envelope and then ship it off to the state university's agricultural department, or you can take it in yourself if you're close enough. And then, you know, they'll run all their little tests and then they'll send you back the results. Some universities, it's free. Some, it's like not that much. It just depends on the university and depends on where, like, how much you're getting tested.
Okay.
Yeah. And just to add on to that, I was a part of the College of Agriculture and Life Science at the University of Arizona, and we did a lot of soil testing as part of our labs. And we did have instances where people brought in soil from their house for us to test. So I would say you could probably reach out to the nearest large university or state university near you. And even if not, they do have soil testing kits online, because that's what we were using when we were doing. I mean, I'm sure they have a higher scale of soil testing equipment, like what Allison went over. But when we were doing them for our labs, you can get the kits online and you basically are just adding the droppers to the different soil to test for the magnesium content, stuff like that. So those are probably available online as well.
Okay. And related to that, one of the attendees just commented certain contaminants, for example, POPs, is either not readily available or it's not cheap for people to do. And they just want Are we still, can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, I think we lost you there for a second, Jean. I don't know if it was just me.
Yeah, I apologize. Yeah, that was me. So we've lost power here, but my backup generator is on. So bear with me if y'all can still hear me. We're still live. I apologize for that brief glitch, but my generator has kicked in. I'm still with you. So getting back to that, one of the attendees just wondered if you were aware of state or municipal resources, for example, city programs that might offer this kind of testing. And if not, that's okay.
That's okay. This is Michelle. I think also another resource is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease mm-hmm. Registry. They have soil kitchens or soil shops. And so they can always reach out to their local public health agencies who have resources at ATSDR to find out if there's a if there's going to be a soil shop in their area.
Okay.
And there is also a website. We can provide that information for you too, because I know they've been promoting that for a while now through mm-hmm. the Brownfields program, which is also under Superfund, but it's a different program, obviously, to do that. And then some people, some places like New York City constantly have that going on.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing soil testing. So yeah, I think between our Brownfields program and others, we could probably help you out with that one.
All right. So we're going to go into some questions about the gardening tools or resources that they're using at home. And a number of people chimed in with just concerns if the potting soil or the garden soil that they might be bringing in, is that actually clean? Is that free from persistent pollutants? Or are they going to be bringing in issues when they're using clean soil at home?
That kind of falls under, where is it? Like researching pesticides and fertilizers that you'll be using. Definitely mm-hmm. should go and research, you know, like if you're using Miracle-Gro, if they've ever had any problems in the past where their soil's been contaminated, or any kind of fertilizers or pesticides. Those are mm-hmm. where, at least in my experience, I've seen a lot of the problems with CECs coming from are the pesticides and fertilizers that people have used in the past. Now that's more common with, like, you know, the big agricultural companies and their like major uses of pesticides and fertilizers, but it's still a good thing to kind of do a little background research and make sure that those companies have, if they've had a problem in the past, they've fixed it, or, you know, if they've ever discussed having a problem in the past with their soils being contaminated.
Okay. What about municipal compost that's given out? Did you see anything, or have you encountered that? They're a little bit concerned that the free compost they can get from their local city might have some CECs in it.
That, at least I don't know if you guys have seen anything about that. I personally didn't see anything about that. But I would definitely, if you're concerned about it, I would definitely like get it tested, send it off, or do some testing at home and see.
Yeah, I'm not certain, but I just remember seeing in some of the research papers I was looking at, they utilized compost in some of these remediation experiments. So I don't know, you know, it would obviously vary depending on what's going into the composter and where you're getting your compost from, but I don't necessarily think it would pose an issue, but I don't want to speak definitely because, you know, I'm not positive.
Okay. And Did you encounter a recommended clean soil thickness for these raised gardens if they were going to plant or garden on an independent structure? They're just wondering in your research if there was something that was typically recommended. How much clean soil did they need?
I didn't see any definite answers. It kind of varied between sources because everybody just kind of says slightly different things, but it's definitely at least, 4 to more inches of clean soil just to make sure that a majority of those roots are within that clean soil so they don't uptake anything from the bad soil.
Okay.
But yeah, it was at the minimum, it was, I think I saw 4 inches.
Okay. Okay. And related to that, go ahead.
Oh, you're good. I just wanted to add to that before I forgot to. I would think I would also recommend just a quick Google search of whatever state you live in and just look up urban gardening growers guide. That's where we got a lot of our information. And I know for me, being from Minnesota, it was like the University of Minnesota Urban Growing Guide. And that can have different regulations for what they might like recommend for raised beds and everything, because, the United States has very vast climates and some people experience flooded areas more and stuff like that. So I would say that's probably like your go-to reference. You'd be surprised actually how much state universities have out there for urban gardening.
Yeah, the only problem is I feel like when we were going through and looking for these guides, there were like those handful of states that have like nothing, you know what I mean? So I can't remember the states off the top of my head, but you might run into trouble if you're trying to look up one of those guides, like Ashley said, but New York is pretty good about it. I know Ashley just said Minnesota. So just, you can look ahead of time, do some research, and something should pop up.
Yes.
Right. Speaking and to build on what Allison said, I completely agree with her. That's probably a direct contact. The first 4 inches is a direct contact. But if you're really talking about the plants and growing into depth, that would be different. So I completely agree with, what Ashley and Aaliyah said too, is like really look up your state and what they're proposing, because that could be different. And the only reason I say that is, there could be states where there's freeze thaw. And so some of these contaminants through freeze thaw are like popping up into direct contact situations. So you really, I guess that's the thing about our Superfund program. Like, we're very site specific when we talk about these things. It's really difficult to say on a national scale because they are very site specific. And so those are things that these interns have done an amazing job of trying to nuance during this this whole project, is these site specific issues across the nation and, trying to bring that to light. So thank you. Thank y'all again so much for your hard work.
And Michelle, there are loads of thank yous just like that coming in. People really did appreciate the presentation. So I want to thank you for shining a light on that. I've got a couple more questions that I think we have time to get into, but I did not want to miss this one. There are some state regulators who are chiming in with documents that their states have put together. You all were just naming some states, so I didn't want to miss some of these others. So Massachusetts, they said that their Department of Environmental Protection, the Mass DEP, has a document that's called Gardening Best Management Practices for Non-Commercial Gardening. So you might find it under non-commercial gardening, not using the phrase urban. There could be some other terms you can search for. And it's been pretty useful. And they actually wind up including it as a resource when they have a hazardous waste site in their state to any people living nearby that site. So I did want to thank everybody who's been chiming in with some other resources and documents. We'll be sure to collect these and share these with our presenters. I'm going to move here, though, to another question. And someone noted other presentations and research where they specifically said metals in vegetables that were grown in these contaminated urban soils found almost undetectable levels in the fruiting parts of the plants. For example, the tomatoes, the peppers, the cucumber, the actual fruit that the plant produced. Did you see something similar in your research?
I think Ashley will probably be able to give a better explanation, but just to touch on that real quick, I think, yeah, it definitely depends on the crop type and the specific plant uptake mechanisms, because they might be, you know, the contaminant might be taken up in the roots and then it just sits there and it's not going into the fruiting body, or it goes into the shoot, but it's not going past that. So, but I'm going to pass it over to Ashley.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you, Aaliyah. And again, like Aaliyah said, it is very specific, contaminant specific, or even plant specific, but there is a general trend that trace metals have a harder time to for the translocation aspect. And that really comes down to the inorganic versus organic pollutants, and how organic pollutants tend to be more hydrophilic and are able to, you know, move, or hydrophobic, might have messed that up, but either way, they're able to transport more freely. And so yes, that I definitely have come across a lot of that information.
Okay. We did have a quick question here. If uptake through pesticide herbicide application has been considered in estimating your plant uptake, was that a factor that you included?
As in, like, the, I guess, the contaminants that are, that come from pesticides?
Yeah, yeah, that they would be part of the factor. Yeah, that was directly included in the research. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if it was shown on the first table where we listed the specific CECs, but it is in there in the report in a lot, like, deeper, a deeper dive. Specifically looking at organochlorine pesticides.
Okay. Okay. Just a clarification here. They noted that pharmaceuticals were not really mentioned as CECs, and they just wondered if that was intentional because they simply rank really low on the risk or impact scale, or did you just not have a lot of information to include them, or is it a little bit of both?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Yeah, I feel like when it came, we considered it, but when it came down to it, it was kind of a little bit of lack of information and lower risk, and just kind of needing to refine the report.
Okay. Yeah, I think it might have been just outside of the scope of the contaminants that we were looking at. I believe Michelle, when we were going over comments from the previous webinar, pharmaceuticals, there were a few other ones on there that were just outside of the scope of the project.
Okay.
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, some of these contaminants could be considered pharmaceuticals, like arsenic, for instance. It's a pesticide. It could also be arsenical, pharmaceutical. But yeah, we did, Aaliyah's right. We decided just to only focus on the ones that we found at Superfund sites.
Okay. I wanted to take a quick question here on your research gaps. And if you look at your research gap item number 2, so I think this goes further along in your deck, they wondered in that research gap, which I think was 2, there we go, number 2, were you referring to bioavailability of the plants to the contaminants, or bioavailability of people to contaminants in the plant?
Bioavailability of the plants to the contaminants.
Okay.
If I'm understanding that question correctly.
Yes. Okay. And I am scrolling through, like, there are probably 50 more messages that are still here in the Q&A. But good news, ladies, a lot of these messages are links to resources, studies, best practices documents, other things that they think would be useful or relevant based on some of the dialogue that we've had here today. So I don't want you to worry. There's not 50 more questions to respond. But I do want to thank everybody who's been chiming in and sending in resources or recommendations for other resources that they could turn to, other data sets, someone's even shared a state-by-state list of soil testing labs and other cooperative extension offices that might be other ways to get inexpensive soil testing done. So I just want to thank everybody who's been chiming in. That's awesome.
Oh my gosh, I know. And in fact, there's one from FDA, they want to poach y'all. So, mm-hmm. Hey,
absolutely.
contact me if you're interested in internship or fellowship at FDA. So I know, right, ladies?
Well, I do want to let everyone know that we will be collecting all of this information, and some of the resources and links we'll be including in the archived version of the seminar homepage, so that when we have a recording available, you'll be able to visit an archived page and access some of the links and resources that are being shared with us by the audience. So we will make sure that that link to the state by state soil testing resource is made available to those of you that replay the recording. I just want to close here letting you know that lots of thank yous from individuals. You've had people on from all over, including Europe. So they really appreciate your work, and they found this to be a really well put together presentation, and they appreciate what you're doing, and they want to see you all work on all of the ideas that you've talked about in the future. I think perhaps in the interest of time, we might move on to start closing things out. But Ashley, if you could bring us back to that final slide that had your contact information. And I do want to remind everyone that their information is here. We also have that information on our seminar homepage. But and same for you, Michelle. If there are individuals who want to talk offline on some of the items that were discussed, can they reach out and contact you all?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. All right. So Ashley, Aaliyah, Allison, any final thoughts before I take over and close out today's webinar?
I just want to say thank you again. And yeah, if you want to reach out after the last webinar last year, I was more than happy to meet with a handful of people over Zoom and everything just to talk more about it. It's something I know we are all passionate about, but I know I personally very much am so. So I would love to talk to anyone and everyone who's willing to listen and to give me information. So I appreciate you all being here.
Yeah, just building off what Ashley said, big thank you to everyone who's joined in, and also for all the resources, because like Ashley said, this project is sort of like a puzzle, and we need some of the missing pieces, and you know, you have to look around to find them. So even from last year's webinar, we got a lot of information we needed to continue this year's report. So thank you guys.
All right. Well, with those thank yous, I'm going to go ahead and swap out a few views here and go through our final reminders. I do want to echo the thanks, not only to the team here at EPA that helped pull this presentation together, to our wonderful presenters, as well as those of you who are on our support team here in the background that helped pull off today's session, and all of you, the well over 300 individuals who joined us from all over the world for today's live session. There were a number of questions that came in related to recordings and certificates and accessing resources. So I'm going to walk through those final reminders before we close things out today. So the first thing that I encourage you to do is to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network, which is at cluin.org. We do have a wide collection of resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. And if you haven't done so, please be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. I send that out on the first of each month, and we'll highlight free online training sessions like today's webinar, along with other websites, documents, and events that are related to hazardous waste sites. I encourage you to visit us and sign up for that newsletter. As I noted at the start of today's session, there is a unique seminar homepage. It's shown in red on this slide, and it will be available from today forward. On that seminar homepage, which is the same place you went when you registered, it's the same place you went to check in, it's the same place I included in the reminder emails for a session. It's available from today forward, so feel free to bookmark that and reference it later on. There are sections there where we have already posted the presentation materials. We've also included links to a number of the previous webinars and reports that were prepared and highlighted in today's session. So all of the documents that were highlighted by our speakers, you already find them on that seminar homepage. And there's also a link to the event feedback form, and that's how you'll get a participation certificate. So make sure you visit the URL shown in red here. And if you fill out that feedback form, at the bottom of the form, there's a box you can check to certify that you were here for the whole thing and to request a participation certificate. As soon as you submit the feedback form, you'll then have access to download or print out one of these certificates. We'll also email a copy to you, but sometimes those get caught in spam filters. So I encourage you to download it from the confirmation screen. If you happen to share the line or share a space with multiple other people who didn't register on their own, so you set up a conference room and other people watched from your location, simply give the link to the seminar homepage to those who joined with you. They can fill out that feedback form on their own and get their own participation certificate, even though they didn't register individually. And for those of you who are lucky enough to be watching the recorded version of today's session, right about now in the recorded version, there is a button above my head in the upper corner that will have a link straight back to that seminar homepage with the feedback form. So you can still share your feedback based off of your replay of today's webinar. So again, that URL is shown in red. You can come back here anytime to get to the materials, to share your feedback, request a certificate. And we will be posting the recorded version here in about 1 week. I'll be working with the organizers to go through the recommended resources, picking out the best ones, and then also adding them in on that archived page so that we'll have a whole collection of the crowdsourced list of resources that we've all put together here as a group. So I encourage you to look for that archive email and then feel free to share that with others that you think will enjoy and benefit from the material. So with that, again, one big thank you to each and every one of you for joining us today. I want to thank our presenters and our organizers and our support team, and I hope that you join us on a future internet seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so much for joining us.